This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is Davina McCall, a queen of prime time for a long time. Her glamour, warmth and willing are ideally suited to the small screen. Big Brother, comic relief, Million Pound Drop, Long Lost Family. Her TV shows span the channels and the choices of millions of viewers. She stands out from the immaculately coiffed pack for her ability to talk to real people like they are real people. Her sheer bloody-minded gumption's interesting too. A couple of years back, she completed a 500-mile triathlon, raising well over £2 million for a charity helping the disadvantaged. She herself knows that life can be tough as a little girl. She rarely saw her mother and would go on in her teens and 20s to fight drug addiction. She says, being famous has its downsides in the same way as not being famous has its downsides. I'm very, very grateful that I got famous after I got clean and after I was 25, which meant I'd worked in the real world and struggled to pay my rent. So welcome, Davina McCall. An important feature of your life these days is, and we get the selfies of the flat stomach, and you came bouncing in here today. You look like you've already done a workout. Have you?
I haven't.
You haven't?
I haven't. No, it's okay. Don't worry, Kirsty. I'm not that amazing. People always say to me, oh God, do you work out every day?
And you don't?
No, because I have a job and I've got three kids, and trying to crowbar it in is really difficult. And I got up at 6:30 this morning to get the kids breakfast and then came in here, and I sure as hell wasn't going to wake up at 5:30 to do a workout.
Delighted, yeah. And indeed,
see?
A little relieved,
yeah,
to hear
you see
that.
It's good.
The work that you do, and of course one of the things that you're best known for is for a decade presenting Big Brother. You know, a lot of it does scrutinise people's lives. Mm. You talk to people about the minutiae, the intimate, the difficult moments of their life. The quid pro quo of that is, of course, you then get asked about those moments. And you've been very open about your life. But is there any part of you that feels a little bit uncomfortable with revealing yourself? Because we all have the right to a private life.
The thing that I have to tread really carefully with, which often I just want to blur about, is my husband and my children. And, you know, I'm the one that's famous. I'm out there. Everybody knows about me. But I do run things by Matthew. If I'm going to talk about something, we went to marriage guidance counselling and I said, I think it would be amazing if I could talk about that, but how do you feel about it? If he'd said no, I would have not talked about it.
And all of your three children have September birthdays.
Yes.
And I read once that, you know, Davina's children were born in September because Davina had commitments to Big Brother. And
this is true.
This is true.
Like, I love Big Brother so much, and the idea of somebody else presenting it, it was like over my dead body. So I said to Matthew, we are not trying for a baby until after December. And so there we are, three birthdays in September.
Good to clear that one up.
Yeah.
Tell me about the first one. What is it and why have you chosen it, Davina?
Oh, the Divine Comedy. Neil Hannon, there's something about his phrasing and his musicality and the way he orchestrates a piece and the way that he can sing really searing love songs but use very comedic lyrics but make them sound terribly serious. He's just a genius. I love the lyrics in this song. It's quite romantic and naughty and saucy and then quite heartbreaking, and it's called Our Mutual Friend.
No matter how I try, I just can't get her out of my mind. And when I sleep, I visualize her. I saw her in the pub. I met her later at the nightclub. A mutual friend introduced us. We talked about.
You in some sort of ecstasy.
I'm in raptures.
I should tell our listeners that was our mutual friend, The Divine Comedy. Let's talk a little about the early days then. The very early days. You were born in 1967.
Yes.
Your dad, Andrew, your mum, French, Florence.
Yes.
How did your parents meet each other?
I think they met on a boat going between France and the UK. And they both sat in the corridor, stayed up all night talking, and fell in love, and that was that.
You've written of her that she was eclectic, naughty, impish, funny, irreverent and captivating. Tell me more about her.
She was born to Pierre and Olga, and I think they were very loving people, but they were incapable of kind of loving her in a nurturing parental way, so they just threw money at the problem.
And throughout her life then, and let's concentrate on her early life when she was a young mum, she had alcohol and drug problems, and how did that affect her behaviour as a mum, from what you can remember early?
My first recollection would be that she just would forget me. When I was about 8 or 9, I nearly drowned. I was hit on the head in the sea by a little boat, you know.
Yeah.
I choked and I came up, a woman saw it and waded out to me and lifted me up out of the water and just hugged me. And I remember hugging her really tight and calming down. And I remember standing on the beach thinking, shall I go and tell mummy? And then thinking, well, there's no point because she won't mother me. She always kind of came first. So her feelings and her worries and her life was always more important. We always sort of worked around her.
And I suppose to anybody who's been the offspring of an addict, that is a very, very familiar thing because they have their primary relationship and it's with their drug of choice and it's not going to be with the kids. So when your mother and your father divorced, it was your father who was granted custody, as people were in those days, granted custody of you. How much was explained to you about what was happening?
Nothing, actually. And I knew that my mum had gone somewhere and I didn't know why she hadn't come back. And I didn't know why I was living with my granny. And I felt a bit guilty because I loved my granny so much. But I thought, I've overstayed my welcome. Like, poor granny, she probably doesn't want me here anymore. But actually, she loved me and she was desperate to have me there. But I didn't know. So it was very confusing.
You did spend a little bit of time with her now and then.
Yes, in the holidays.
Do you have memories from that time?
Yes, it was pretty chaos. Thank God I was my sister, who was born when my mum was 16. So my mum was 15 when she got pregnant with my big sister. And she lived with her French grandparents, so my mum's parents.
So this was really exactly the same situation, repeating itself.
In France.
Yes.
And so thank God I went to stay with them when I was in France. So they were actually pretty solid. But my mum would kind of come and go in chaos. And I don't want it to sound like I'm complaining about it because I thought she was kind of brilliant, but also leg-crossingly embarrassing, but exciting. And she had no boundaries for me. So I could go out whenever I want, wear whatever I wanted, wear high heels, wear makeup, do anything. Anything. And I thought at the time that was great. But I know I look back now and it was so destructive.
So on the subject of your mother leaving when you were very young and not coming back and not being present, you said, I'm quoting directly here, you said, I don't think she found it easy.
Mm.
I'm wondering what evidence you have for that she didn't find it easy.
I haven't really got any evidence of that. I would like to think that my mum found it difficult. Otherwise, that's really depressing.
Let's have your second piece of music, Davina McCall. Tell me about this and why particularly you've chosen it.
Well, this is an ode to my dad. And he introduced me to jazz, and Pippi, his mum, and he are jazz fanatics. But my dad in particular loves Duke Ellington. And obviously everybody knows the Nutcracker Suite, but Duke Ellington did just the most brilliant swing big band version of it. And this is the overture.
Thank you. That was part of the overture from the Nutcracker Suite composed by Tchaikovsky, arranged by Ellington, and Strayhorn performed there by Duke Ellington and his orchestra. Davina McCall, then, as we know, you said you went most of the time, well, a lot of the time in your early childhood to live with your grandmother and grandfather. Your dad was working in London. Tell me about home life then with your grandparents.
So home life was amazing because my granny looked after her mother-in-law, Grandma. She was just called Grandma. My life in France was always pretty chaotic and mad. I really appreciated the roots that Pippi gave me. And she was always cooking. I mean, it was perfect. You know, she was in the garden. She grew her own veg. She grew her own fruit.
And did you have an abiding sense as you were growing up of difference, of separateness from other people? Because if you were picked up from the school play, it would be by your grandma, not by your mother. You had a sister, but she wasn't with you. Was that something that sort of built in you incrementally as you grew up?
Mostly the thing that made me feel slightly apart from was the fact that I couldn't really talk about what was going on in France. I had these two lives and I, in some way, wanted to protect my mum because I was worried that people might not let me go back if I told them what was happening.
Oh.
Because I wanted to see her. But at the same time, I knew what was going on was pretty mad and that if I mentioned it, I might not be allowed to go back. I guess only people that have experienced it or are experiencing it will know what I mean, but it was weird. I wanted to be with her.
Well, of course you did, because you're hot-wired to love your parents. Mm. That's the way we're built, is to have that attachment. So that's the deepest thing you can have. Is there a particular moment when you think, wow, she really did that? She really just did that?
I mean, there's a lot, but let me think. It's etched into my mind, this electric blue floor-length fur coat. And we were out once and she wasn't wearing anything underneath it. And she would just flash people because she thought it was funny. And I was just dying inside. Get guys giving her interest and her loving the interest, but me hating the interest that these men are giving her and feeling protective, but feeling vulnerable and needing protection myself and not knowing where to get it and seeing people pity me.
How old were you, for example, with the fur coat?
Oh, that, 10, 11.
Let's have some more music, Davina McCall. Tell me about your third. What's this?
Cyrita. I mean, nobody's really heard of her. This was the famous track, but the whole album is amazing because it was produced by the inimitable Stevie Wonder, and he was married to Cyrita, and it really reminds me of my mum. She came back to live in London after she'd split up with my dad. She met another Englishman. My sister used to come over and visit sometimes. This was her third husband. And this was the album from that time in our lives. And we danced to it together, me and my sister. But this song in particular, it's a corker.
This song goes out to all you fellas who think your kisses are as sweet as candy. But honey, got you beat by a million miles.
Your kiss is sweet, as sweet as candy. But honey, beat your kisses by a million miles. Your kiss is sweet, as sweet as candy. But honey, beat your kisses by a million miles.
That was Cyrita and Your Kiss is Sweet. You can still do the moves to that, Davina McCall,
can.
I should tell people.
I can.
People.
Still got it.
You went to live with your stepmom and your dad in London when you were how old?
I was just turning 13. And
the perfect mix, then, for
a
restless... Tell me what you got up to as a teenager.
We lived in Shepherd's Bush, and I absolutely loved Shepherd's Bush. It was so different to Surrey. And I loved the mix of music, suddenly opening my eyes to, like, loads of reggae. There was loads of, like, sound systems happening out in the streets. It was so exciting, and it felt like being reborn. Unfortunately, I think I was already slightly careering off the rails when I went to go and live with my dad and my stepmom. You know, I was already smoking, I was already sort of drinking.
Age what?
13.
Right.
Started smoking at 12.
How did you get on in school?
I was pretty smart back then. I'm pretty sure most of my brain cells waved goodbye in the late 80s in the rave scene. But I was a smart kid, and I got 9 O-levels then, and I got pretty good grades. But by the time it got to my A-levels, I just got 2 A-levels. I flunked out. I was doing maths. You know, I'd be up in my room, and they'd think I was studying, but I wasn't studying. And I'd go round to people's houses under the guise of studying, but I wouldn't be. I'd be at my boyfriend's. I mean, I was pretty naughty. And I feel quite sorry for my kids because I just know what they're going to be trying to get up to, so I'm ahead of it all the time.
And when you got those results, did your dad sit you down at the kitchen table and say, oh, OK, what's happened here then?
My dad was amazing. He just said, what do you want from life and where do you want to go? He said, because you can do anything, but you just have to really want it. And at the time I was like, I don't really know. I just love music. And I sort of fell into a job at Models One on the men's desk representing male models, which at 19 years old, you can imagine, was just the best job ever. And I did that for a few years, but all the time I was trying to either sing or do something musical. I was running nightclubs at the weekends, which, again, was all about the music and live bands and clubbing. So everything was kind of pointing towards, I was trying to either get a career in music, and then MTV launched, and then that was my shining beacon. I want to work there.
Hold that thought. Tell me about this piece of music, Davina McCall.
Funkadelic is really from the late 70s, and it was when I started really beginning to really enjoy music, and it was the track that used to play quite a lot at the Camden Palace, which is now Coco in Camden. And I was about 14. I mean, nobody ever looked at ID. We were all drinking. It was mad. And this is Funkadelic, One Nation Under a Groove.
That was Funkadelic and One Nation Under a Groove. You told me during that, Davina McCall, you were that stage dancer.
I was, so embarrassing. But also, I just wore the most amazing clothes because I used to go out in next to nothing. I went out once in a body glove swimming costume and a pair of Timberlands, and that was it.
You know, it's a very cool sounding teenage life, and you started to do what many people do. You used drugs recreationally and thought, I can handle this and it's fun. And then, of course, it did what it very often does, which is the fun turns into something else. By the late teens, what was the reality of your drug use?
I thought I had it all under control, but it was very much sort of white-knuckling, right, I'm definitely not going to do anything until Friday night. And then Friday night would turn into Thursday night just to see me through. And the weekends were getting longer and longer. But really, I got bad in my early 20s. And the thing was that I used to look at people in my early 20s when I went out clubbing, and I started meeting a few people that were clean. And I'd think, how is it that I'm so out of it, but I'm not having a good time, and yet you're not drinking or taking any drugs, and you're much happier than me? And I just couldn't quite get it. Taking drugs is like Russian roulette. Some people can take drugs and then put them down and walk away and have an adult life, never having touched them again. And some people pick up the drugs and they can't put them down. And that was me. And I'd really quite carefully stayed away from alcohol because I could see that my mother was an alcoholic. So I thought I was being quite good because I didn't really drink that much. So I'll just take a few drugs instead. I mean, what kind of common sense is that? Ridiculous. So I did end up in a complete mess.
And when you were in a complete mess, what did your life look like?
Until the last year, you wouldn't have known that my life was a complete mess. I mean, I had a job. I mean, I was never on time, ever. I didn't steal. I didn't inject. These are all things that made me different from other awful drug addicts over there. I'm not as bad as them, so it's okay, I'll carry on. I would have been absolutely destroyed if I thought other people thought I had a problem with drugs.
And what was the turning point?
When I realised that other people knew I had a problem with drugs. And my best friend, Sarah, said to me, you know, you're the topic of every dinner party I go to. What an absolute mess you are. And that you're lying to me. I know you're lying to me. I know you're taking heroin. And I know, you know, so I can't talk to you anymore. I can't hang out with you anymore.
But immediately, what did you do when she said
that? Oh, I was like really angry, swore at her tons. You know, what kind of a friend are you? Like, just got really attitude-y, really in her face, and then left. And then just cried non-stop for about 8 hours and thought, this is it, I've got to stop. I had nowhere to go except for to stop. So I did, and I went to a meeting that day, and that was it.
That day?
Yep, I went to take a bunch of flowers to my friend. I was feeling really, really terrible at that point, like quite sick and awful. And I went to see her and I said, I'm really sorry, you're absolutely right. I'm a mess and I'm going to change. And I went to a meeting that night at 6 o'clock and everybody talked to me. I thought they were all going to go, ugh, junkie scum, get out. But they were really nice. And that was it.
Let's have your next piece of music, Davina. Tell me about this. We're going to listen to your fifth. Why have you chosen this?
If you talk about sort of euphoric recall, about a time of my life when I was clubbing all the time and this was the track that they would put on and they could turn on every single light in the club and everybody would have their hands in the air and there was kind of a collective energy that went to this song that anybody that was around at the time will feel it again when they hear it. It's a weird thing. It's like a button, a switch that switches on when you hear this song. It's called Can You Feel It? I certainly can when I listen to this track. It's by Todd Terry. Could you feel it?
I could, just about. That was Can You Feel It by Philippe B and Todd Terry. Many millions of people watched you in 2014 do this. I'm going to use the word horrific because it was horrific. It was a 500-mile triathlon. You were going from Edinburgh to London. You were doing it for Sports Relief to raise money. You raised a very significant sum, over 2 million quid. What possessed you to say yes?
I always sort of think, oh, no, I can't do this, I can't do this. But I've got such low sort of expectations of myself. And then actually I do it and I think, God, I'm capable of so much more than I give myself credit for. So sometimes I think, oh, I don't think I can do this, but I'm going to say yes because maybe I will do it and at the end it'll make me feel amazing.
And does it?
Yeah. That Sport Relief Challenge, I achieved things that I literally didn't think were humanly possible of myself. I mean, I'm stronger than I ever imagined I would be.
One of them was swimming Lake Windermere, and you had a sort of morbid fear, really, of deep, dark water. And lots of people will understand and share that fear, indeed, but they wouldn't put themselves in Lake Windermere at God knows what temperature and at God knows what time in the morning and say, I'm going to swim across it. You did that, and you became at one point, certainly from the documentary I watched, hypothermic, or you were on the edge of hypothermia.
Oh, I was hypothermic.
You were hypothermic.
I mean, I kept going. I don't know what kept me going. At one point, it was so painful. Sarah, my best friend, was there, and she said it was the most painful thing to watch ever. Because at one point, I was doggy paddling. I couldn't lift my arm out of the water anymore. I was just shutting down, and I was just desperately trying to get to the other side. The temperature of the water was 5 degrees. The shock of putting your face in that kind of water, it's like somebody's ripping off your face with a claw.
But you could have quietly turned that down and nobody would have ever known that you had a conversation where you said, do you know, I've done a lot.
I don't know, but why did I say yes?
Well, that's what I'm asking you.
I don't know, Kirst. It's really weird. Mentally, it took me a year to get over.
Did it?
Yeah. I mean, I'd cry every time I thought about it for a year. I saw some footage of Anne, and she'd gone to school. This was a girl that I'd visited before. She was working in a quarry, and there she was in her school uniform, and they showed me that on Sport Relief Day. I was an absolute wreck after that.
Time for some more music, Davina McCall. Tell me about this. You're sick.
Oh, what can I say about Kate Bush? This woman, I went to see her in concert last year and howled through the entire concert. Every single track, every breath she takes is magic. And this is from Hounds of Love, which is my favourite Kate Bush album, and this is Jig of Life.
Hello, old lady. I know your face well. I know it well. She says, na 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 na. They're sitting in your mirror now. Is the place where the crossroads meet. When you look into the future, never, never say goodbye. No, 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 no.
That was Kate Bush and
Jig of... Got me going, that did.
That was Jig of Life. Davina McCall, you are a mother of three, as we know.
I am.
How has, we all, mother, if we do mother, influenced by what's happened to us? How much has what happened to you that we've heard about today influenced the way you try to be a parent and the way you just naturally are a parent to your three kids?
I was constantly just trying to be perfect. I was so uptight and tense, and I thought I was being really relaxed, but in retrospect, I look back and... You know, I gave myself such a hard time about everything. I was desperate to not repeat the same mistakes and to be everything. And you can't be everything all the time. It's impossible. And also, you know, Matthew needs attention and I need attention and there's life. I had to work. So just I had to just let go of the reins a bit. I became a bit of a control freak. It was exhausting.
Did your own relationship with your own mother repair at some point?
For a moment, for a nanosecond. So when I married Matthew, she'd been clean and sober for a while and we'd been speaking. She was living in South Africa. And when I married Matthew, I said, would you like to come to the wedding? I'd love you to come to the wedding. So she did. And before we went to a meeting and we sat together, we both cried and we held hands. And it felt like...
When you say a meeting, just to be clear, an AA meeting.
Narcotics Anonymous meeting, yeah.
Right.
It was what I'd always dreamt of, you know, my mum supporting me and me supporting her. It was beautiful. And then we had a great time at the wedding. And then we went on honeymoon and Matthew and I popped over to Paris on as part of our honeymoon to go and see my mum. She went back to South Africa 6 months later. Matthew took me up to Scotland for a night for my birthday. And on the day of my birthday, a piece came out in the paper and it was like a headline of something like, Mummy, I need a meeting. And she'd sold a story about me and us going to meetings. I'd never actually talked about going to Narcotics Anonymous because it's an anonymous fellowship and she blew my anonymity sort of right at that moment and her own and sold pictures of our honeymoon and it was terrible. I mean, it was the worst. It was like being stabbed in the heart and she twisted it hard. And she did that a couple more times. She sold a couple more stories. And I kept going back and trying to build bridges again and think that this time would be different.
It end with an acceptance by you that this simply cannot be repaired?
I was in counselling when she got really sick at the end to try and come to terms with the fact that my mother will never mother me. I got the news that she was very, very poorly. And one night in bed, I just lay there with my palms facing upwards and I said out loud, I forgive you. I forgive you. And then a few days later, she died. And my sister and I hugged each other. We cried a bit. And then she said, I feel relieved. And I said, so do I. And, you know, for the first time, we could stop hoping that our mother could be anything other than what she is. And we could just live with... you know, her memory, and remember her more fondly.
Let's have some more music, Davina.
So this one is in memory of my lovely sister. And we played this at her funeral, which I know sounds really sad, but it's always a song that makes me actually feel really happy. And I am the harmonising mother. My kids always joke about I have to harmonise to every single track. And my harmonising started with this track. It's called Never Let Her Slip Away by Andrew Gold.
I'm a little bit dizzy, I'm a little bit scared. I guess I never felt this much aware that I love her. I'm hoping that I never recover. 'Cause she's good for me, and it would really make me happy to never let her slip away.
That was Andrew Gold singing Never Let Her Slip Away, and it was chosen by you, Davina McCall, because you said you played it at the funeral. This was the funeral of your sister. She died in 2012. She was young, and it was a relatively sudden illness that she'd had. Tell me about her importance in your life, because anything I read or see, and going into that piece of music indeed, I get the feeling that you were extremely close as sisters.
I think because we shared our mother, and, I mean, I've described bits of it to you, but... nobody will really get it without knowing her and knowing what she was like. We really only came together in my sort of mid to late 20s and became really close then. What was quite brilliant about my husband is I met my husband and I was sharing a flat with my sister. And then when we moved out of the flat and moved in together, he was then a boyfriend, she came with us then. And then we got married and she stayed with us. And lots of people were going, well, so is Caroline going to move out? And I was like, no, I don't think so. And Matthew's like, no, I don't think so. Then we had a dark period when we moved to the country and she didn't come with us because she was like, I hate the country. And then she was like, oh, sod it, I'm coming. And she moved into a cottage next door to our house. And it was a great time. You know, she was just in and out of our house, part of the fabric of our family. I'd almost never have a bath without her sat on the floor next to me talking.
When you reach this island all on your own, as I cast you away, will you have a plan? I mean, will you be getting things ship-shape? Will you be...
Well, I think the one thing that I've got, which is great for the desert island, is that I do definitely by now know that I am capable of a lot more than I think I'm capable of. I'll be planning from the get-go. Water immediately, then shelter, then I'll go about planting or getting some food. So I'm on it. I'm already on it.
Tell me, Davina McCall, about your final disc. What are we going to hear?
Sarah McLachlan was somebody, she's from Canada, and she's not that well known over here. She's an artist that my husband introduced me to. He lived in New York for 5 years, and I fell in love with her as I fell in love with him. And this was our music. Yeah, I probably shouldn't say any more than
what?
That.
What? You've got a very cheeky look on your face.
It was our sexy music. If you need to know, Kirsty, it was
I hear you. Yeah. Let's hear it now. Sarah McLachlan and Angel. It's time now, Davina, for me to give you the books. I give all of our castaways a copy of the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare, and they get to take their own book, their own favourite book, along with them. What's your book going to be?
It's Still Life with Woodpecker by Tom Robbins. And it's a love story, and it's so far removed from what I normally read. I'm so shattered by the time I go to bed. I want a nice, simple book to read in bed. And so I go for sort of crime thrillers normally. But this book was a love story and it was set on a packet of Camel cigarettes. And it's so out there, but it's so beautifully written and descriptive. So I'd take that.
That's yours then. You're allowed a luxury as well.
Do you know what I'd want to take is a bath? Because I find true peace in my bath. And the children... They kind of know that when I'm in the bath, I'm out of bounds. So I've got candles going. Do not set foot in this bathroom. This is my time.
We shall give you that bath with the bath foam and everything to go with
it. Thank you.
If you had to save just one of these discs out of all of the eight that you've chosen, which one disc would it be?
It would be Angel, Sarah McLachlan, because it was the beginning of a new phase of my life with Matthew. And ever since I met him, I've looked forward and not backwards.
It's yours, Davina McCall. Thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert
Thank
Island
you.
Discs. You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.
This is the BBC.